It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The New Yorker's Jane Mayer is back with us now with a new post-election paperback edition of her best-selling book about the Koch brothers, Dark Money, the Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Political Right. Let's see what's new in this edition. Hi, Jane. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Great to be with you.
By way of background, let me start with your vocabulary word, Cocteopus. Remind us of what kind of a creature that is?
The Cocteopus is the nickname given this amazing political machine that the Koch brothers built up. And it's a kind of a creature that has multi-tentacles through much of American life that most Americans feel but don't see.
And one of the tentacles that they apparently did not exert was they were planning to spend $1 billion on whoever the Republican nominee for president was, but in fact they did not because it was Donald Trump. Why did the Koch brothers abstain from funding the Trump campaign?
Well, he wasn't their kind of Republican, and he even made fun of them. He suggested that any of the Republican candidates who went begging to the Kochs and their donor group for money were puppets. So Trump actually got a lot of, I think, momentum out of running against this idea that Washington is corrupted by nothing but a handful of billionaires who seem to own the government. And so he raised expectations, of course, that he would be very different. And the Kochs didn't like that, though they've actually, lots has changed since then.
Yeah, and Trump ran on, among other things, draining the swamp, which was indicating independence from the billionaire dark money class that you write about, you know, in the book in such detail. And in the introduction to this new edition of the book, you write pretty much immediately after being elected, Trump turned to the very same people he railed against during the campaign to staff his burgeoning cabinet. We all know about some of those picks. Did he also turn to the Koch brothers?
Well, their lobbyists and members of the donor group that they put together, which created a jackpot of money on the right in American politics, are all over the Trump administration, in senior positions and in less visible positions. I mean, the tip-off really should have been election night in New York, where Trump went to accept the victory, and in the crowd was David Koch. Surprise, surprise. The family that supposedly was not for Trump, one of the two brothers was right there in the crowd celebrating him. And soon after, you take a look at their transition team, and it was crawling. The Trump transition team was crawling with Koch operatives, Koch lobbyists. And one of the most important members of the Trump administration, of course, is Vice President Pence. Well, it's interesting, but Vice President Pence was the number one choice of candidate for president that the Kochs had, that Charles Koch had, in 2012. He wanted to draft Pence to run. Pence is very much a Koch person. He's gotten tons of money from them, and his policies are exactly what the Koch brothers want. So you've got him right there at the elbow of the president, and they're feeling better about Trump all the time. Tim Phillips, who's the head of Americans for Prosperity, which is the major group that's the political advocacy group for the Trumps, tweeted just this last week that there's almost no daylight between what he wants as the Koch's political director and what Trump's doing. The quote was, almost no daylight. So it's so interesting to me because people thought they were getting a change, and they voted for a change. So how do these same hugely powerful forces wind up all over the new government?
You single out Trump's pick for CIA director, Mike Pompeo, former congressman from Kansas, as being one of the single largest recipients of Koch campaign funds in Congress. Why were they interested in Pompeo?
Well, Pompeo's nickname has always been the congressman from Coke. They were in business with him. They helped set him up in business, actually. And, he was number one in his class at West Point, a rising star, and he did a lot of their bidding when he was in Congress for their business. So now he's in a terrifically, pivotal position as director of the CIA. And that can't hurt a multinational global corporation. It's the second largest private company in America is Koch Industries, and it does business all around the world. So it's handy for them.
Maybe it's worth taking a step back and reminding people what the Koch brothers, despite having, being this Koch-topus with so many tentacles out funding so many political campaigns, even though they didn't fund the Trump campaign, they still had money into a lot of Republicans for Congress. Taking a step back and talking about what they want, is it that Koch Industries is essentially an oil company, so the main thing that they're after with all their money is a timid anti-global warming policy?
Yes, that is sort of number one on their list. And number two, or maybe in tied with that, is to weaken all the regulations on companies that pollute. Theirs has been the Koch Industries is the largest producer of toxic waste in America and one of the top air and water polluters and climate polluters, according to a number of different studies. So that's very important to them. That's their profit center. They're in the fossil fuel business. They want to stave off alternative energy of various sorts that compete with oil. And they also are very interested in cutting taxes. They have tremendous incomes. They each earn about $1 billion a year, and they don't like paying taxes on it. And they cast this not as a matter of self-interest, though. When they talk about it, they've spent years building up a kind of an advocacy machine that argues that these policies are not just good for them, but good for all Americans, and that the smaller the government, the better it is for America, the lower the taxes, it's better it is for everyone, that private business can do better than government. That's pretty much been their line for about 40 years, and they've subsidized its propagation through think tanks, through academic programs, through advertising, through candidates, they've been the primary funders of extreme libertarianism, which is what that is, and they've really moved the dial on it in American politics.
My guest is New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer, the new paperback edition with new material of her book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Political Right, is just out. And let's take a phone call. Jan in the East Village. You're on WNYC with Jane Mayer. Hi, Jan.
Oh, hi. Yes. I wanted to ask Ms. Mayer if she knows who ultimately is funding the Trump campaign. I remember he made quite a big show of saying he was funding his own campaign, and people were saying, no, this is a loan. He's lending his campaign the money. He fully intends to be paid back. And now that, of course, he has all the power and he has won, I know he started going after Goldman Sachs money. I'm wondering, have the Koch brothers paid him back? Do we know who has paid for Trump's campaign ultimately?
Well, thank you for the question. One of the top donors to the Trump campaign is a man named Robert Mercer, who is the co-director of a tremendously profitable hedge fund that's out on that's based in Long Island, Stony Brook, Long Island. It's called Renaissance Technologies, and Mercer is a math genius who's kind of really revolutionized trading with algorithms and made just hundreds of millions of dollars off of it. I think he's one of the biggest funders behind Trump. He's also been a member of the Koch's donor group. The Kochs were very clever. They just pay for their own political agenda themselves. They put together a group of about 400 of the richest conservatives in the country, billionaires and multi-millionaires. And Robert Mercer's been a charter member of that group. So he went from working with the Kochs to funding Trump. But again, Trump is not everything that the Kochs dreamed of. There's some policy differences he has with them, and I think they recognize he's unreliable. He's erratic. They wanted somebody who was more reliably in their camp, in their corner.
Jan, thank you for your call. You know, I want to go back to your previous book and take a detour for a few minutes, and what I might call your previous obsession before the Koch brothers, your 2007 book, The Dark Side, The Inside Story of How the War on Terror Turned into a War on American Ideals, which you were on for several times to talk about during the Bush administration. That, of course, was about torture and so-called black sites where interrogations took place outside the U.S., therefore outside U.S. law. I guess you noticed, Jane, that these topics are back in play thanks to one of the president's executive orders this week. What's actually new there? Are you looking at that?
Definitely. I mean, I just kind of can't believe it because, I mean, I guess we should because Trump talked a lot about how he, you know, wanted to waterboard terror suspects during the campaign and how waterboarding wasn't bad enough for them. And, you know, it was a lot of kind of tough guy rhetoric that he was throwing around. And the truth is, it's just that there were a lot of lessons learned from the Bush era, and they were learned by the military and by the CIA and by the FBI and pretty much by anybody who's sophisticated who's been following this. And the top lesson was that torture got really bad results. It makes people spew out bad information, false information, anything to make it stop, and it walks people who do it into legal prosecution. The Supreme Court ruled that they could be prosecuted for doing these things. Our laws ban torture in every way, in every circumstances. America was founded against that kind of, you know, inhumane cruelty towards people who are, you know, enemy combatants. From the start, the country's been against it, from George Washington's era. So to have Trump come in and then say he wants to reopen a review of this, though that it just kind of boggles the mind, because nobody in the government who lived through it wants to go back there. Just nobody, no matter what their politics are. They've all learned it was a terrible idea, and it was completely counterproductive. So it's kind of as if Trump's not been keeping up with what, you know, recent history has shown.
And he may just be doing this for effect, to shock people, maybe to take their focus off other issues. I don't know. And certainly he's got basically no support. We know his defense secretary, General Mattis, is not for bringing back waterboarding or other things that could be classified as torture. We know that his CIA director, Pompeo, is not for it. John McCain and Lindsey Graham and others are speaking out. So is Paul Ryan. The other part of that that's not getting as much attention is the part of the order that says, look again at using black site prisons.
And that exactly, was exactly, you're right. That's right.
Remind us, what were black site prisons, or are they? Are they still around?
No, they were closed down by Obama and in his own executive order. And the thing is, that can be overturned. Trump has not done that yet, but it became scandalous worldwide for a country like America that, you know, reveres the rule of law. What these sites were constructed to do was to be able to take prisoners and put them someplace outside the reach of the law, where they wouldn't have any rights, no right to a trial, no right to defend themselves. And it violated the whole spirit of the American Constitution. But that is something that Trump could do if he could convince other countries to take these prisons again. You know, the thing is, the countries where these prisons were opened in the first time once it emerged, they were all secret, but once the news emerged of this, there were international scandals, and these countries were deeply shamed and embarrassed. And so the Trump administration would have to convince other countries to do it again.
We have several people, Trump supporters or Republicans, calling in to say, so you wrote this whole book on the Koch brothers' influence through their money on the rise of the political right. What about all the liberal donors? What about a book about George Soros? What about the fact that Trump had fewer outside donors supporting his campaign than Hillary Clinton did supporting her campaign, which is one of the reasons that some people didn't like Hillary Clinton? Does this misrepresent
true.
A big picture?
Well, I think that I totally agree that big money, big outside donors, that the influence of private interests over the public's government is a bipartisan problem. And Hillary Clinton's big donors were one of the things that really tarred her ties to Wall Street, those speeches to Goldman Sachs. It really undermined her moral authority and her standing as supposedly a progressive and independent voice. So it's a problem on both sides of the aisle. The reason, and I've actually written by a very large piece in The New Yorker about George Soros, just as big as the piece I did about the Koch brothers. A couple of years ago, when Soros was putting all the money he could into trying to buy the election, that was in 2004. But he's receded quite a bit as an electoral force, and so he's not really as interesting to someone who writes about money in politics these days, because really the Koch brothers' role was on an unprecedented level. They were talking about trying to put $889 million into the 2016 campaign. This country's never seen anything like that. And again, it wasn't just their own money. It was a group. They've created kind of an independent party of billionaires, and that's something new, too. So, you know, as someone who writes about politics, they're where the action was, and that's why I was writing about them.
Derek in Montclair, you're on WNYC with Jane Mayer. Hi, Derek.
Hi. This goes back to the issue of the Koch brothers, and I think your guest is mischaracterizing them. She noted that they're, in her words, extreme libertarians, and they are certainly libertarians, but I think that is much more predominant in their motives for spending on politics than simply serving their financial or business interests. Their libertarianism may certainly benefit their business interests, but I think these are has been repeatedly demonstrated through interviews and publications that these are individuals, the Koch brothers and many others who are wealthy and not so wealthy, they donate for the purpose of achieving policy results, some of which may incidentally benefit them, but they do so also for cultural and ideological reasons. And so I think the left, and Ms. Mayer's book is an example of this, misunderstand the motives for wealthy donors giving. They're not simply giving money to policies that will simply benefit them personally, but rather for ideological reasons that they think are going to benefit everyone.
Jane?
Well, that's certainly how they portray themselves. But, you know, the book took 5 years and is based on interviews with hundreds and hundreds of people, many of whom know the Kochs and worked with the Kochs, worked for the Kochs. And many of the people who worked for them are the most cynical about the Kochs. This is not a leftist critique. This is a critique that comes from the people who know them best, who say they are among the most hard-hitting, self-interested people you will find in this country. They often put their company's interests way ahead of their politics. There's numerous examples of them breaking with their own ideology when it's good for their company. You need to read the book.
Do you have an example of that? Is there an example of that that's easy enough to say?
Right in the beginning of the book, there's a scene where, I don't know if you remember, when Obama came into office, the one of the first big issues was whether to bail out the banks and the TARP program.
Mm-hmm.
And ideologically, libertarians should have been against bailing out the banks using government money. And this was really the basis of much of the Tea Party rhetoric, was against bailing out the banks and using the government that way. The Kochs, publicly, their organization first was against TARP. As soon as the stock market hit the bottom, they flipped on a dime, and they went back and they commanded their people in Washington to support TARP. They wanted that bailout. Their fortunes were in jeopardy. And I've got, you'll take a look at it, and you can see it's documented. And some of their top people in Washington say, yep, it. Once they were threatened and their own money was threatened, they were all for that government activism.
Derek, thank you for your call. Please call us again. And Jane, you write in the book that with all the talk of fake news as a relatively new phenomenon, the Koch brothers had been funding the types of smear campaigns and incendiary bloggers that ultimately gave rise or supported things like questioning Obama's Americanness or his fictitious origins in Kenya. What did they do in that respect?
Well, when the Tea Party began to take off, the Kochs, by then they'd built up a pretty good infrastructure of political operatives around the country in this organization they run called Americans for Prosperity. And Americans for Prosperity helped organize the Tea Party rebellion around the country. And at those rallies that they ran off, there was a lot of very ugly rhetoric. And so belatedly, it's interesting, you know, Charles Koch has talked about how he really doesn't like the tone of politics these days, and he's disgusted with the way that the Trump campaign expressed itself. But his organization was helping to fund some of the ugliest rhetoric in the country that I've ever seen. I mean, there were the very, very angry things going on in Washington where people were spitting at representatives from Congress, and an organization that the Kochs ran gave out a prize to a woman for, called her Blogger of the Year or something, and I looked up her blogs, and they were calling Obama the cokehead in chief and saying that he was schizophrenic, and it, you know, it's just baseless, ugly, trashy politics, and they were celebrating it, giving trophies to it at that point. So I it's hard to see them now kind of saying that they want to float above that. Maybe they've changed. You know, I'm not, anybody can, but, or maybe they have regrets, but they were up to their eyeballs in it back when Obama was president.
Jane Mayer, New Yorker staff writer, is the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Political Right, about the Koch brothers, now out in paperback in a revised post-election edition. Jane, thank you so much.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, Nate Silver from 538. He's taking a fresh look at what went wrong in polling before the election and what went wrong in the news media before the election and how to go forward from here. Stay with us.